Greetings, everyone. If you will turn to Isaiah 44, those words from which he just sang, we will follow along a little further and see what this chapter says. In the context of the first commandment, which says, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." While you're turning to Isaiah 44, all of you think that Baptists, Catholics, Methodists, Episcopalians, all of the Protestant mainstream theologians, most of all of our churches in the United States, which is a Christian nation, printing and producing, distributing and translating more Bibles than any country in the history of the world, has long since put idolatry in the dim, distant past. It belongs now only as a tourist attraction for those who take the inland passage from Vancouver Island and see the totem poles of the Aleuts and the Pacific Northwestern Indian tribes, or the stone statuary standing, peering blindly as if across the horizon, expecting the coming of some white gods on Easter Island, or on the ancient monuments of Babylon, Egypt, Greece, and Rome. Surely the idea of an idol is not a modern concept. And surely the average Sunday preacher in his pulpit talking to his congregation is going to feel, well, there's no reason to preach about the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," because even the Methodist down the street or the Church of Christ on the other side of town or the Jehovah's Witnesses or anybody else acknowledges God, and nobody in our nation is bowing down before an idol of any kind. This is rather anomalous when you look at the irony in the 44th chapter of what all God says about an individual who will plant a tree, an ash tree, and then what becomes of it. He begins to say in verse 5, "One shall say, I am the Eternal's, and another shall call himself by the name of Jacob. Another shall substitute with his hand under the Eternal and surname himself by the name of Israel," taking all sorts of titles that imply that they are God's people. "Thus says the Eternal, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Eternal of hosts, I am the first and I am the last, and beside me there is no God. And who as I shall call and declare it, and set it in order for me, since I appointed the ancient people, and the things that are coming and shall come? Let them show unto me, or unto them. Fear ye not, neither be afraid. Have I not told you that from that time, and declared it? You are even my witnesses. Is there a God beside me? Yea, there is no God, I know not any. They that make a graven image are all of them vanity, and their delectable things shall not profit. And they are witnesses, they see not, nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who has formed a god, or molten a graven image, that is profitable for nothing." Notice a little later he says, "The smith," verse 12, "with the tongs, works with the coals, and fashions it with hammers, and works with the strength of his arms." He's hungry. And he gets tired doing all of this. His strength falleth or faileth. He drinks no water and is faint. He's working himself into exhaustion on an object made with metal. The carpenter stretches out his rule. He marks it out with a line. He fits it with planes and he marks it out with the compass and makes it after the figure of a man, a sculpture, according to the beauty of a man, a perfectly formed Greek god, as they used to call them. They even say today that athletes are built like a Greek god. That it may remain in the house, an object that he sets up in the corner of the salon somewhere, or a niche for that purpose, and then he bows down and worships it. He hews him down cedars and takes the cypress and the oak, which he strengthens for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants an ash, the rain nourishes it. Here are the seasons coming along, the high and the low pressure, the moist air meeting colder, dry air, and the rain. And he observes the sun and the moon, the advancing seasons, and looks at the Milky Way up there, and observes the fact that the largest of all plants, the trees that have hundreds and hundreds of years as a lifespan, can grow to become a mighty oak or an ash or a sycamore. And when it is huge and large and big enough, having observed all the passing seasons, knowing what it takes to grow a large hardwood, he cuts it down. He'll take it for a man to burn. He'll get his winter firewood from part of it. And he will take thereof and warm himself. Yea, he kindles it and bakes bread, carries it indoors and fires up the old wood stove, and Martha or Maud bakes the bread. Yea, he makes a god with what's left over and worships it. He makes it into a graven image and falls down thereunto. He burns part thereof in the fire, and part thereof he eats flesh, and he roasts with the wood and is satisfied. Yea, he warms himself. He sits by the fire of the same tree and says, aha, I'm warm. I've seen the fire. And the residue thereof he makes a god. Even his graven image, he falls down unto it and worships it and prays unto it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. There's no such thing as idolatry in the United States of America today, is there? Is there any such thing as idolatry in the church? Would anyone ever be guilty of breaking the very first of all the commandments? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Perhaps we ought to think once again of the definition of idolatry. What is, in fact, an idol? The Apostle Paul says, as we will see a little later, covetousness is idolatry. Let me put it a different way. What motivates you? What turns you on? What gets you excited? What drives you? What energizes you? What is your raison d'etre? What is your reason for being here, your reason for living? What is your profession? What is your political party or point of view? What is your feeling of nationalism or racism or xenophobia? How do you feel about blacks or whites or Chicanos or Polacks? How do you feel about people of Eastern Europe or communist Chinese? What triggers in you emotional responses? What triggers excitement, enthusiasm, expectancy? You saw, maybe some participated, in what took place in the streets in Chicago when Michael Jordan and all the Chicago Bulls came home from the NBA Finals. Wasn't that exciting? You know what would turn me on as a basketball player some 37 years? Watching Michael Jordan do a diving, twisting, turning, hang time, whop, slam, dunk, nearly knock that rim off the backboard and tear a hole in the net, and I say, wow! And the little kid's looking up, and they get it in slow motion. He's got these shoes, whatever it is he advertised. He's got his own shoes now, I think. And he goes sailing up like a missile taking off for the moon. And he hangs up there and looks around like God. And he says, there's the basket. Poof! And then he comes back down like any ordinary mortal and runs off and tells you which pair of shoes you ought to buy. Isn't that exciting? I mean, when grown people, some of them weigh 340 pounds, there were four of them in my hotel this morning, are out there jouncing with the big globules of yellow fat. They could be carrying it in a wheelbarrow. And they're excited about Michael Jordan. Why? Because they would die of a heart attack walking across on the yellow light. And Michael Jordan is an athlete. And they worship before Michael Jordan. Someone once did a little extrapolation of what Michael or perhaps Magic or some of these people are paid. And they figured out it's something like $12,000 a basket. Every time you see him dunk the ball, $12,000, the cash register is ringing up. And all of us are paying for that, aren't we? We're sitting there in front of the television set. Wow, Michael! Now, I could turn you on if I said, Michael is coming to your house this afternoon, couldn't I? Especially if you're only 25 and play basketball in the city league. I'd say, oh, I'm sorry, wrong Michael. It's Michael Jackson. You'd say, wow, far out, man. And if you're a teenager, man or woman, black or white, you'd just go crazy about that. Michael Jackson? Oh, wrong Michael. I'm sorry. Michael Fox. You'd still say, wow, a movie star coming to visit. That would turn you on. What if I said Michael was coming? The archangel. Moment of doubt. Now, I don't know about that. An angel, you said? You know, if you've ever been in a crowd where they're trying to worship a hero or an idol, a human idol, a living idol, you know that you can get yourself killed. Let me just go through a few things with you and let's ask the question as we go along whether or not idolatry is really obsolete in America. Who are our stars? Was it General Colin Kelly when he said, first we're going to cut it off, and then we're going to kill it? Was it General Schwarzkopf? Was it the average G.I. Joe, man or woman, in the Persian Gulf, our heroes that we welcome home? Who is your hero? Now, I can go by in the gift shop of my hotel and look, and there are the kind of peephole, dirty linen, watch the antics of the perverts, movie kind of publications that tell me about the latest role, shows a picture of Dolly Parton. Her face looks like she's been hit by a Mack truck. It's all made up and all sorts of things going on. You probably see people shaking their head. See, you've already seen it at the checkout stand at the local supermarket. And there she is. Now, you know, if you were a CEO of a large corporation and you suddenly divulged that you're a closet queen, or maybe you were you're the subject of a paternity suit from a boyfriend who's been living with you, you might as well just kiss your career goodbye, right? I mean, it's all over. Your career is over. But if you're a star, now what's a star? Well, a star, how about, some people want to pronounce it Betelgeuse, but it's really Betelgeuse, perhaps, the middle star of Orion that I've talked about, which if you would look it up in the encyclopedia, they would show you the orbits of Earth, Venus, Jupiter, and Mars, and they would show you that this middle star of Orion, you can go out and see at night, if moved into the position of our sun, is such a gigantic supernova that it literally, in its huge, gigantic size, would absorb our entire solar system. And we call an actor a star? You know, time was in the 1800s when actors were looked upon as fakes because a man's word was his bond. And you said what was right and what was square and what was true. And you didn't say what was wrong or fake or in mimicry or in acting. And anyone who could put on and then pretend and act out a role was looked upon with a great deal of suspicion. As a matter of fact, many of them were run right out of town. When an acting troupe would come to town in the Old West, they were given short shrift. They were sometimes tarred and feathered and run out of town on a rail because oftentimes they looked upon them as thieves, and many times they were. They certainly were false. They were fakers. They were what? Mimics. They were aping other people. They were pretending. So you could call them not a star. Why don't we call them what they are? The great pretender. How about a professional liar? Wouldn't it put things in a different category if instead of the star, in the starring role, he's lying, it would be a different point of view, wouldn't it, if instead of starring, they were just lying or pretending? Now, every morning I see it, and so I have a routine, a lot of which I cannot go into, some of which is not necessary to cover, but when Good Morning America, which is one of my habitual news programs in the morning on television, together with CNN, which I will get to in a moment, comes on, usually they will give you all the people are going to interview and the good little things about the latest cookbook or whatever, and then the star they're going to interview. But now, right now, time out, Mike Snyder has the news. Oh, yes, well, nuts. By the way, Gorbachev is over there. The Soviet Union is ferment. There's war and the potential of civil war in Yugoslavia. There's all kinds of problems worldwide. The entire economy of the world is in terrible trouble. Looks like we're headed for a Great Depression. But, oh, my, time out. Mike Snyder's got the news. Hurry, Mike, and we'll get back to the star. And then a few minutes later, now it's time to interview the star. I do one of two things. I click it to CNN immediately, or I get up and go into my word processor and get to work on my latest article, which in this case the other day is an article along the same subject I'm talking to you about today, which I'm offering in a letter, which is coming up. I will not join the morning worship hour. I do not care about the difficulty of their latest switch in roles. I do not care whether she or he finds it difficult being away from the kids on location. I do not care about the paternity suit because of their homosexual partner. I do not really care that they've been a closet queen all their life and suddenly the entire world is hanging on every word because they find out Rock Hudson had AIDS. I just wonder why Doris Day showed up at his wedding. If I'd been she, I'd have got me an entire case of the toughest kind of mouthwash has ever been invented. Because she used to kiss him in certain movie scenes. And I'd have been gargling mouthwash nonstop for weeks, but nevertheless, she showed up at the funeral. Stars. Think about what is out here for a minute. We can go out of this room, we can drive down this street, we can find a 7-Eleven store, a bookstore, a country, a mom-and-pop store, a supermarket or whatever. We can find in there People magazine, but we can also find about two dozen other magazines, all of which have the same cover, a woman in partial stages of undress, and they are Glamour, Bizarre, 17, Ms., Femme, everything that suggests that every woman should have this deodorant, should use that kind of electric razor, should have this type of orthodontist's work done or whatever, should bathe and powder and do all these things to herself so she will be absolutely Miss Sex Queen. When you pick up these magazines, of which there are dozens out there that children can go and see, on any magazine counter with the centerfolds, some woman in an obscene position saying, let's go get to know each other better. You're saying, look at that potential grandmother there. Look at that wonderful girl planning to be a housewife. Look at that career wife and mother and helpmeet for her husband who is going to go out as breadwinner and build a family together, aren't you? Isn't it amazing? Movie magazines, exposés, people publications, people magazines. People want to be like these idols. That's why they can sell everything from toothpaste to soap to automobiles. They don't show you a cutaway of a greasy engine because nobody, including most of us who think an automobile is an extension of our personality, so if you're driving around in a red sports car, that's me, that's what I am. I project myself, that's the way I feel about myself, or an old, rather stodgy-looking four-door gray sedan driving very slow like Grandpa used to. That's me. That's my projection of my image. But when you go to buy one, they just show you on TV or the placard when you enter some sexy blonde slithering over the hood, or they show you the thing careening around corners with gum and candy wrappers blowing at about 65 miles an hour, and they show you people barely stopping in the rain and this and that, and they show you a Lexus. They show you the hood ornament. They show you the grill. They show you the little emblem of the car. They don't tell you a thing about the gas mileage or how long it's going to last or how dangerous it is or the fact that the BMW has been through the back of so many garages and run into so many people because it runs away. They put on the gas and instead the car accelerates. They don't tell you about a lot of the problems that the cars have had. So there's no honesty in advertising. It's all sexual. It's all subliminal. It's all erotic. It's all suggestive. It is all trying to create the lust for the product, get you to desire it, get you to lust for it, to want it. So let's come back and ask a few questions about ourselves. What do you enjoy in life? What is most fun that you have? What's your most fun thing you do? I'm doing one of my most fun things right now. This is some of the greatest fun I have in life, is doing what I'm doing right now. Or a television program. I love it. That's really great. Or sitting at my word processor, venting my spleen about these things I'm talking about right now. I love that. Love doing that. Because the Bible says, cry aloud, spare not, and show my people their sin. So I enjoy that. But I also enjoy fishing. Vegetarians, I'm sorry. Tune me out. Hunting. Okay, tune me back in. I enjoy golf. I enjoy certain sports. I enjoy basketball. Start to enjoy that again. Have fun. I don't go to movies. I'm sorry to tell you that. I do not go to movies. Now, that's not quite true because in the last 14 years I may have gone to two or three. But that's not many in 14 years when a lot of people go to five or six a week, is it? Nor is it many when people go home with their arms laden with these rotten, unbelievable, demonic, obscene, hideous movies available in the local video store. And those, don't you wish you'd have been a franchise owner of about 100 of those way back 10 years ago when they started to just pop out everywhere, and now they're practically in every block in America, where you could have run about six of them and had people running in there and renting movies for 99 cents a copy for one night? Who are our idols? What turns us on? What really gets us steamed up and excited? How many people are there careening around on the freeways here on a weeknight, really impatient and angry at rush hour because they might miss the Wheel of Fortune? They got to get home on time to see the wheel. There are people who have written Vanna White, who has bad teeth, a scrawny body, and looks like she's in the last stages of anorexia. You ever see her little bitty arms? They're about as big as pasta. Look at her next time you see her on there. It's unbelievable. She's built like a two iron. You ought to see her. Look real close. But she says, bye-bye. And you know, that's all she does. Walk over there and turn a little number. Walk over there and turn a number. And then at the end she says bye-bye with bad teeth and all that, and she gets letters from men who are proposing to her. She gets a ton of mail. Oh, Vanna, I want to marry you. You believe it? What excites you? What can't you wait to get home to see? What must you see when you go downtown and you wait in line with a sweaty crowd of fat people trying to get in there to get your ticket, clutching it in your hand, and go in there, and you sit there, and you buy a giant city water tank-sized Coca-Cola, and a gigantic box of popcorn with butter and animal fat dripping all over it, salt, 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 and you sit there, watching on the silver screen other people act out the kind of life you wish you had. But certainly not acting out the kind of a death you want, but I mean some of it's chainsaw dismemberment, and people will do the same thing. I think the popcorn's a placebo. It kind of brings you back to reality. This is popcorn. You don't want to really think about what you're seeing on the screen up there. You think of television, you think of motion pictures, of books and novels, journals and magazines, then you've got to think of human heroes in the sports field. Is it absolutely obscene? The other day they showed, what is it, The Rocket? What is his name? That's his nickname. One of our athletes went up to Canada. You've probably already seen it. It was on CNN. I've seen it three times. They played that same scene three times. 78 yards on a quick reverse on a punt return up in Canada. They got the football season started before ours does, I guess, and they're paying him $4 million a year. Let me tell you something. We're doing a fairly substantial work of God. We're on not quite 50, I guess, television stations all around the United States. All that literature you see out there. Our 30-some employees. Our approximately, 75 or 80 church congregations scattered around the country. We do not use as much money in one year as that man makes for entertaining people. He makes $4 million. We're so large now that last year the gross income for this entire work that we're doing for all of that to reach people's lives, $3.6 million per year. We're getting big. Someday we'll be up there with some of the baseball pitchers. Now think about what I'm telling you, because I'm talking about you, aren't I? Now, you're not going to just sit there and get away from it. You're going to have to admit it. Some of you people do go to movies. And some of you people are sitting there transfixed in front of the greatest conversation killer in all history called television. An automatic babysitter, a one-eyed monster, an absolute obscene, demonic, satanic-inspired piece of garbage that shouldn't be in anybody's living room. I look at CNN, yes, and I watch news, yes, and I have been known to stray into some entertainment programs from time to time, so I'm talking about me too, but I'll guarantee you I would be happy to compare my television watching habits with 99.44% of the population. I'll guarantee I don't watch it one-tenth of the time that most of them do. I personally would rather get away from it and be up in the mountains and looking up at the sky from the top of a Colorado mountain and acknowledging how great God is than sitting there watching all the garbage there is available on television. I want to come to another subject right quickly. It's one that is particularly obscene to me. It doesn't touch the lives of many of you. It's about as exciting to those over 40 as going down to the local barbershop and watching haircuts. But that is rock music. The other day, some of the fans apparently decided, since the rock star, quote-unquote, star, didn't show up on time, they decided, well, we ought to probably kill somebody. So they killed a couple people, and they trampled a few other and put them in a hospital and had gigantic riot. Every now and then these fans do that. So here's some guy, angular, bony, long feet, long nose, pasty face, kind of pimples all over, and he's got a shock of orange hair swept forward in a mohawk. And he leaps out like a scarecrow that found his clothes underneath the garbage can in the back of the Goodwill store. A couple of holes in it you suspect were burnt in there by acid. He's obviously high on drugs, and he's got this guitar that he's jabbing into the air like a lewd phallic symbol, gyrating his scrawny hips, screeching unintelligible sounds into a many-decibel microphone that is beating on the bodies of all these people out there, who after they're gone, the police sadly have to gather up all the little plastic bags and the broken ampules and the needles and the little joints of marijuana that are left, and the last ambulance has departed from the OD on drugs to the hospital, and they clean it all up. This was a rock concert. We can go out of here and go to the music store in less than 20 minutes, can't we? We can all get in our car and find a music store in one of these shopping centers, and you can go in and pick up those albums. And you can read words like people saying they want to eat each other's excreta. Am I shocking somebody? Sorry. You can hear it on records played nonstop in places teenagers frequent. Movies that feature this kind of music, television movies, rock operas, and the kind they're called, acid rock, that's out of date now. Now it's heavy metal. You've heard about the lawsuits. You've heard about some of the groups. They're actually writing songs that urge dismemberment of human bodies. They're writing songs that urge satanic worship, demon worship, death. They're writing songs that encourage suicide and murder. And the words are blatant. Now, sometimes they will write a song with a satanic message and then type the letters in reverse and make these unintelligible noises backwards just for the effect. You all remember Alice Cooper, that was a male. The finale of his act going all over the United States was to pick up a live chicken. And the crowd went absolutely wild when he came center stage and bit the chicken's head off and then tossed the bloody beast out there among all these people who got splattered with the blood. They went absolutely crazy over it. I ask the question again. Are there any idols around our society today? Are there human beings, are there people you would do almost anything to get next to? You'd like to be there, and if somebody said, you're going to be able to sit down and talk with Michael Jackson or Michael Jordan for 5 minutes, and you can ask him any question you want to, what would go through your mind? What about General Schwarzkopf? What about George Bush? What's the vice president's name? Never mind, I'm just kidding. But what if a great, you know, famous politician were going to come to your house and you had an opportunity to actually talk to him? Now, I want you to follow through with me on this because I want to characterize the average American person who is rushing to get home to see the wheel, to see the stars. He's got two movies under his arm or in the back seat. And he's going to do his thing. Work is over. I just found out the name of a local restaurant I never heard before in my life, TGIF. I didn't know. They said, we're going to have a little snack at TGIF. I said, what's that mean? He said, it means, thank God, it's Friday. I said, are you kidding me? Yeah. Let's see. Did somebody put me on? Am I buying a joke or is that real? It's real. Okay. Well, what they do is they're open every day, so they want you to pretend it's Friday every day. But the average assembly line worker in Ypsilanti that hits the freeway and is heading home, that can't wait to get there with the two movies in the back seat, is going to do what? Worship. What is it that energizes him? What drives him? What compels him? What turns him on? What makes him reach for his wallet? What does he spend his money for? What is he concerned about, or she? What is the interest in life that they're going for? What's fun? In our nation, idolatry is one of the most common of all sins. The reason Almighty God placed that first is because it is one of the most common of all sins. He said, I am the eternal thy God which brought thee out of the land of Egypt. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. The second commandment, thou shalt not make unto me or unto thee any graven images of anything or any likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or on the earth, or in the sea, or anywhere else. You're not to bow down yourself to them and worship them. He said, I, the eternal thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the children, or the fathers upon the children, unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Those commandments are put in that order because they're the most commonly broken. Most people think that perhaps by the time you get down to adultery, by the time you get to thou shalt not steal, yeah, there's a lot of crime out there. But for every criminal who reaches his hand to steal, there are 10,000 people who are lusting and who are doing the very same thing spiritually and are not aware of it. I'm going to turn to the first chapter of the book of Romans right quickly just to get a portion of this, although this whole chapter deserves several sermons all by itself. And I was preaching about this last week or 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, when our youngsters were about to leave camp. Because it has to do with atheism and with the denial of the existence of God and, of course, with idolatry. Beginning to read in the 16th verse, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold back, as it should read, or suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known about or of God, about His Godhead, the divine family, who He is, all about Him, is evident to them, manifest in or to them. For God has shown it to them. Now, what is He saying here? Well, let me break in and tell you what He's saying in just commonplace, good old American English. He's saying that a scientist, an observer of the universe, someone who observes the motion of the astral bodies, like the ancient Aztecs, like Indian tribes in America that set up miniature Stonehenges, like the Druids of northern Scotland with Stonehenge itself, like the ancient Egyptians positioning the entry into the queen's chamber so the sunlight would hit it exactly a certain spot, like other people who have built pyramids so that at the winter and the summer solstice, one half is bathed in sunlight and the other is perfectly shadowed, like people who have known and observed for all of these millennia and generations of human experience, they are seeing demonstrative proofs or demonstrations of God's great power. So, to put it simply, go to your local library, if you don't have a set of encyclopedias at home, and do yourself a favor, and simply look up the word eye, E-Y-E. Now, most of you here are seeing people. You don't know the process of the rods and the cones and the iris and all the expansion and contraction and a little overpressurization relief valve that might get stuck, which causes glaucoma. You're not aware of all the passage of light and impulses through that nerve that actually projects a picture to your brain upside down. Your brain then reinterprets it and puts it right side up, and you're looking at a gray-haired little man up here at the pulpit. You're not really aware of all that. But if you were to look up eye and then study the eye of a fly, and do you know? Some of you don't know. You're going to think I'm putting you on. Clams got eyes. You know that? Ever see a picture of a scallop with a whole row of beautiful little blue eyes on the end of what looks like a little bitty tentacle? Every one of them is a little eye looking around out there. Do you ever just pick up an encyclopedia and study one part of your body? Well, no, most people don't do that. Why? They don't have time. The wheel is on. They don't have time because they're looking at all this other stuff. They don't have time to look up and look for God. They only have time to pursue entertainment. What it is that inspires them, excites them, gets their hands clammy, turns them on, gets their ears to steaming, gets their hands to trembling, gets them reaching for their wallet, gets the camera out. Oh, I got to get this. Gets their autograph pad ready. Whatever it is that makes them run like a snorting, trampling, grunting, shouldering herd of Yorkshire hogs to the slop trough to get there first, to gobble up whatever is available. That's the way people are about their idols and their heroes. What if instead of seeing someone in such a hurry to get home because he's got two TV movies in the back seat, or he wants to get there in time for the Wheel of Fortune, he's saying to himself, I can't wait to get home because I'm going to be able to talk to God. Now, there aren't very many people like that, are there? I'm not even talking to a lot of people like that, am I? Not really, I'm not. No. But, you know, if there were a hotline there and somebody were able to connect with you at your office or your place of work and say, President George Bush is calling your residence. If you can get there quickly in the next few minutes, we got him on hold. The president wants to talk to you. Well, you'd never make it. You'd recover in a hospital, and he could talk to you. Well, because you'd probably get in a wreck trying to get there on time. Because you would say, wow, incredible. But especially if it were Michael Jordan, Michael Fox, or Michael Jackson, or any of the other Michaels that people tend to worship. Or a movie star. Somebody, maybe a country western star. Maybe Willie Nelson's on the phone. Wow! If you like Willie Nelson. That proves you don't have to have any talent. You can sing through your nose and become a multimillionaire. And all by himself, he's putting out a whole new album to pay off the federal government, which is probably going to settle the national debt by the time he's through, because the guy made so much money, it's unbelievable. Almighty God says that the people who study the movements of the heavens and who are scientists and who study animals and human life have the least excuse of all. The wrath of God is revealed because he said that which may be known of God is evident to them, for God has shown it to them, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. You're part of what has been created. In Colossians, the third chapter, I want to turn to that. Colossians, the third chapter. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, if you're turning. This is a very beautiful chapter, together with Ephesians, the fourth chapter, and has some fantastic spiritual meat in it. I want to begin with verse 1. If ye then be risen with Christ, talking about the new creature in Christ, seek those things which are above. Now that would put most church audiences to sleep almost the minute you uttered those words. Because that is not what turns people on. That does not trigger your thirst. It doesn't trigger your appetite. I could start talking about your favorite drink, or talk about a 3-inch thick filet mignon. I could talk about a big steaming baked potato with sour cream and chives. I could talk about a trip to Maui in Hawaii. I could talk about meeting a movie star and getting her autograph, or sitting down and talking for 5 minutes to Michael Jordan. That would turn people on, excite them, inspire them. If you be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above. What is above? Well, just Mars, Jupiter, Venus, and as I said, the supernova called Betelgeuse in the so-called middle belt of Orion, which is not its real name. God knows all of their names and men don't. Where Christ sits on the right hand of God. Seek, in other words, living forever. Seek eternal life. Seek salvation. Set your affection on things above. That's a command, not a suggestion. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Anything that gets between you and God, anything that demands more of your time than God does, anything that is more of an immediate, intermediate, or long-range interest to you than God is an idol. America has had a love affair with the automobile since Henry Ford put it on the assembly line. You can look in any newspaper and you will see thousands upon thousands of automobiles for sale. Classics, used, new and old. Imports, all kinds of people. I was looking through the local newspaper like I always do when I come to any city, and I'll get the local paper and read through it and see what's going on in the city. And invariably look through a lot of the want ads. Even once in a while glance at the obituary column, and I'm not really kidding when I say that I do that. I do, not to see if George Burns is still with us or anything like that, but just to be doing it, just to kind of get the whole picture of what's happening in the local community. Noticed the horrible accident yesterday in the bridge where apparently a teenager was knocked off and some other people were very badly hurt, and the guy in the boat rescued her, and you probably all read that. It was on the front page this morning. So I try to keep up with that. But if your interests, if that which absorbs your time, if that which you will hurry to do, if that which you will spend money to do, is something other than Jesus Christ of Nazareth and Almighty God above. If your affection, your desire, your love, your interest is on other things other than Almighty God, and I'm going to show you how to perhaps capture that spirit in a few moments, then you may, without realizing it, without being deliberate, you're not the guy or the lady that hewed down the ash tree and made a leering face on it and claimed it was God. No, our idols are not that obvious. We're not like the second most populous nation in the earth that bows down before a cow. India, that worships cows, even though it's a modern nuclear nation. No, we're the modern United States, space age America, with footprints on the moon and an American flag up there, stiffened with tinfoil because there is no breeze. And we are technologically superior with our wonder weapons of laser-guided smart bombs and laser-guided missiles that just beat the way out of the Iraqis, but they still got their super cannon and apparently their nuclear capability, so maybe it's going to be a little bit of a hollow victory after all. Set your affection on things above and not on things on the earth. I don't think, and I include the person talking to you, that there is a one of us that can claim we just batted 100% on that issue. That none of our affection, none of our desires, none of our urgent needing to, you know, the feeling of reaching, grasping, wanting to possess, to have, to accumulate, to get, to be there, to see, to experience something on this earth is just washed out of our mind. And instead, we want to be with Christ in His kingdom. For you are dead. We don't think of that. We think it's wonderful to be alive, but He's talking spiritually. He's saying the breaking of God's laws, including idolatry, claims your life. And the death penalty has been paid by Christ as a surrogate, as a sacrifice in your stead, saying, let the sacrifice, let the penalty fall on my head and take it off of His. So now you're supposed to be spiritually begotten and living a new and a different life with a whole set of new and different values. A gentleman came up to me a while ago and was talking about a real struggle that he is having with his own personal emotional problem that he has to fight and to struggle with. It seems to be worse now than it was before he was baptized. You can predict that will be true, because Satan the devil hates everyone who is baptized and is a new little child in Christ. Satan the devil is seeing a potential member of the family of God on the way toward development. And he hates that. And he's going to pull out all stops and try to hit you with every compulsion. I had a letter from a lady that told me that she was continually having a mental battle with a desire that was just in her mind to curse God. People go through things like that. And I wrote to her and tried to tell her to fill her mind with other things and to read the Psalms. And I was saying similar things to this gentleman, but if you want, as I said, to get the air out of a glass, you fill it with fluid. And so if you have a mind that is battling with these things, you take your mind and you get in control of your mind and you take this human eye and you put it on some words and you focus on them, in whom also ye are circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, and you begin to read. Get on your knees, open up the 103rd Psalm, read a half of it aloud, stop and pray. Read the rest of it aloud, stop and pray. Put into your mind the things of God. That will force out of your mind the things of Satan the devil. You've got to substitute the one for the other. Spiritual therapy is a kind of therapy almost no one ever seeks. And it's the most needed therapy that any of us could have. You are dead and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Now, that's a concept that you need to dwell on for a moment. If your life is hidden, who's going to find it? If anyone is looking for it, Satan, his demons, enemies. If your life is hidden, it's secure, it's safe, it's in God's strong box, it's locked behind an absolute impenetrable vault, and it's hidden with Christ in God. Now, any church, and of course, unfortunately, the church with which I was connected for much of my adult life, unintentionally, not deliberately at all, tended to make the congregation feel like salvation is always an issue in doubt. And like you're not there yet because they took great issue with the Baptist concept, once saved, always saved. Well, I can take issue with that too, because once saved, always saved is not true. Once saved, you're saved. That's a fait accompli. The analogy is, once you were begotten, you were begotten. Could there have been an abortion? Yes. Could there have been a miscarriage? Yes. But there wasn't. Here you are. The spiritual analogy is the same thing. Once you are saved, your life is hid with Christ in God. You are saved. It's an over with, done for, fait accompli. It's an accomplishment of the past. Your life is secure to the family of God. Satan the devil cannot take it away. God won't. Only you can make that decision. You're in control. You can abort by turning back into this world and by actually letting the entertainment of the world, the idols of the world, the ways of the world, the lusts of the world, the standards, values of the world, the system of the world, economic, sociological, political, racial, whatever, actually absorb your mind, your conscience, your concern, your worry, your interest, your time, to where your mind is just going around with mundane, societal, human, physical things. And there's no time for God. God doesn't have a part of your life. I once saw a pie graph, great big circular graph, and it showed how much of our time we spend asleep, and it's enormous. You can't believe it. 8 hours per day out of 24. Add that up for a 60-year lifespan. It's enormous. It showed how much time we take brushing our teeth, going to the toilet, taking a bath, eating, putting on and taking off our clothing. In other words, most of our time, we look like a bunch of otters on a stream bank that had found a carrot. We're out there scrubbing and washing, and we're eating, and we're storing nuts like a squirrel running around thinking winter is coming. We're doing one thing, mostly. We're just pampering, mollycoddling, taking care of ourselves. We're concerned about ourselves. We're concerned about what we eat. Poor little girl's concerned about herself. We're concerned about her, and we're all concerned. And when we're a little older, we don't show that concern in the same way a little child does. We show it in other ways. Like you can see the mouth moving when the rubber is laid and the guy just cuts you out in the street. And you see the... You can't hear it because the air conditioner's on and so on. So somebody every now and then makes an obscene gesture. Somebody piles out of a car, and we got a fight going on out in the freeway. For a while in Los Angeles, they went into a mindless thing back, I think it was last summer, was it not? About a year ago. And people were arming themselves and carrying guns and running along in a freeway and killing one another. That shows you what is out there in this world. So,
When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall you also appear with him in glory. Mortify, that doesn't mean, oh, I was so mortified. No, that means put to death. That means put to death. It does not mean humiliate or embarrass. It means put to death, therefore, your members. Now, that's physical appetites which are upon the earth. Fornication. Let's go in our minds to the local 7-Eleven store. Let's look at the covers of all the women's magazines. Then look at all the advertisements, including panties and bras. Then we'll look at all the men's magazines, and all the advertisements, including the little bitty bikini panties that they want men to wear now. Okay? We'll look at every bit of this. We'll look at all the lives and the spicy revelations of the latest homosexual liaison between a star whose career is enhanced, not over, like the CEO of the corporation. Their careers are enhanced when people find out they've got all these libidinous desires. And you ask yourself if fornication, adultery, getting it on with anybody, anywhere, as fast and as often as you can, is not one of the most insistent, repetitive gongs going off in the back of your mind that practically all literature, books and magazines, movies and TV movies and entertainment is just an insistent theme. If it feels good, do it. Sex, murder, mayhem, arson, anything that is rotten and evil and wrong and contrary to God's laws, Satan the devil has it out there on a luscious big banquet table ready for your partaking. It's out there. It's everywhere around you. And the greatest invasion of your living room is that television set. I'm glad that I had it during the Gulf War, and I'm glad that I have it when a documentary comes on, even though most of the documentaries, especially if they're dealing with wildlife, lions or hummingbirds or whatever, are evolutionary. But I'm still glad that I have it because it gives me material. I'm even glad, in a sense, for the Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday morning worship hour, which I never watch, because it gives me a little bit of fodder to talk to people about. Maybe you watch it. I don't care about those careers. I just do not care, I'm sorry, about somebody that has made a ton of money and has only 4 homes, 5 condos, a Ferrari, a Maserati, and a Mercedes-Benz, and a Rolls Royce, and a 6-car garage to keep his collection of antique cars in, and has a tough time being away from the kids. I'm not interested. Not interested. It just doesn't interest me. Mortify, therefore, put to death your members which are upon the earth. Fornication, uncleanness, and that means every kind of uncleanness, not just physical uncleanness, not talking about, you know, soap and underarm deodorants, is talking about filthiness of habit and mind. We get letters. People say, please pray for me. I'm in prison. He got a double problem. We read this letter Friday morning. And I want God to cure me of my habit of Copenhagen snuff. Now, there's a poor guy with 2 terrible troubles. He's in jail, and he can't quit snuff. We had 3 letters, I think, Friday from prisoners, and we get quite a number. And we get most of them say, I'm in prison for a crime I did not commit. That's interesting because one of my neighbors works as a guard at a maximum security prison down in Palestine below where we live in Texas. And there's not a one in there that was really a criminal, he says. He's never met one. And there are hundreds of them down there, but not a one of them in that jail ever committed a crime. I just say that in passing. Mortify your members upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection. What's that mean? It means illegal affection. What does that mean? Isn't it ugly when you find 55, 60, 65-year-old sheriffs, judges, teachers, daycare operators who are child molesters? Isn't that kind of sick? Isn't that kind of sick? Does your child go to a little dudes and darlings, as they got one down in Tyler, daycare center? You can go and talk to those people, and they're going to look just like ordinary people. You can interview them. You can say, now, what is your policy, and where are the kids going to be, and what is the program, and what about the playground, and do you have a nurse here, and what happens if they get, you know, skinned or cut up or bruised or whatever, and what if children fight, and you may, you know, just wade all the way through it. Is my child going to be taken care of? And they'll come on to you, just talk. Remember this long, years-long lawsuit of this family? You make up your own mind about it. I have an opinion. Maybe my opinion's wrong. But there's a lot more of that out there than you even think there is. And when you begin to see the percentages of Catholic priests that had affairs with little choir boys, inordinate affection, is that anywhere around us? Illegal ungodly, satanic, wrong, perverted affections. Not normal. Now, I'm talking to a group of products. There was a mold, and that mold went like that, but it took about the first 5 formative years and the rest of all your education until you got out of the home, grew up, got a job, went off, got married, or whatever. And that mold was your parents and your local school system and your church background. Everything that it was, all the influential personalities with whom you came in contact, which made you what you are. We are a degenerate people. We live in a degenerate time. We live in a hedonistic, liberal, absolutely Satan-influenced society that says any feeling, and it's all sensory, it's all of the senses, or sensual, I was going to say. It's all of the appetites, of what the eye wants to see, of what the taste buds want to experience, of what the ear wants to hear, of what the skin wants to feel, touch, and so on. It's all sensuous. And Satan is playing away on his music. Come, feed at the slop trough. Enjoy it. Partake. Be excited about it. Want it. Lust for it. And adulate. Want to emulate. Mimic. Be like the people who produce it all. You know nothing about them. Let's see, what was Bernie... I don't know if it was Heimerwitz or whatever. Anyway, Bernie, whatever it was, otherwise known as Tony Curtis. Most people don't even know their names. They don't even know. It's in the almanac, isn't it? You ever look up those names? You can, in the almanac, you can go and get an almanac, and there's a section in there that tells you the real names, and some of them are absolutely incredibly ugly. They could never have made it on the silver screen with a name like that. Like Brugenhammer, you know, or maybe Klutz, or whatever. It just, like Gertrude Klutz, and instead Doris Day. Now, that may not have been it, but I mean, you see what I'm saying. And you can't have a star named Gertrude Klutz. People just won't go to see that. No, they're all about us. They're absolutely all about us. Inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. For which things sake? The wrath of God comes on the children of disobedience. In the which, it is saying now, Paul, writing to a group of people who lived in a city called Colossae, where real idolatry, temple prostitutes, all of it sexual and libidinous in its direction, was all around them. In the which you also walked, meaning lived, sometime, when you lived in them, when you were just absorbed by it, and it was part and parcel of your daily life. But now, you also put off all of these. Not all only these interests, not only the world, but what the world did to you, the product, your psyche, your emotional responses to various stimuli, deprivation, somebody doing something to you that is just plain wrong. What do? You get mad. So you put off these. Anger. If you put off anger, nonsense. Have I totally put off all of anger in me? Absolutely not. I'm willing to admit that before God. I've still got a way to go before something normally would make me furious doesn't at least bother me a little bit. I've learned to control my anger. I've learned to be able to kind of swell up with a whole lot of anger and not pick up a board and hit anybody, or not run someone off the road, or give someone a filthy gesture, but just shake my head and say, stupid or whatever, and then say, well, I probably shouldn't have said that. You know, people in Tyler, Texas can't read the English language. There's one thing Charlie can tell you about. It just drives me absolutely crazy. And that is that people will not run a green light. Now, that doesn't make sense, does it? You're saying, what does he mean? Won't run a green light. Well, it's green and there's no traffic coming. And you're in the left turn lane behind a lady. I'm sorry, it's always a lady, but we'll just say behind somebody. Women, forgive me. I'm just relating my experience, okay? Just my experience. Left turn signal is going, the green light is on, it's a wide open intersection, and there's no traffic coming. But there's a little sign that says, protected left on green arrow. Green light's on, but the arrow isn't blinking yet. She's waiting. Many times I will back up, roar around her, and I'll be way down there about 2 blocks looking in my rearview mirror when she finally turned the corner and come, kind of wondering, well, what did that guy do that for? That was a green light. He wasn't supposed to run that green light. Now, I'm only illustrating something. I'm illustrating the fact that I have not yet got rid of all my anger. Wrath, malice. Now, that's, of course, keeping a grudge and having hatred and malice and animosity to where you want to get even with someone. Blasphemy, filthy communication. Everybody okay in that department? Nobody ever makes some scatological reference. Nobody says some ugly word, try to hurt somebody. Nobody just absolutely, you know, etches glass with some wonderful little tidbit that they say in public. Filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deed. Nobody ever stretches the truth anymore. Nobody ever exaggerates or minimizes. Nobody ever just makes up something right out of whole cloth, because if you really found out where you were when you were supposed to be there, you're in terrible trouble, right? Lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. I want to go quickly, I won't have time to get there, to the 139th Psalm. I wish that we would have time to do a little more in this psalm and go through a great deal of it, but at least we can do a good part of it, perhaps, before concluding. This is perhaps one of the most personal, one of the most meaningful and moving of all of the psalms, because he is dealing with his humanity, with his birth, and with his relationship to God. But more than that, let me propose, I'm not saying all of you go home and get a .22 rifle and shoot your television set. I'm not even suggesting sell it or give it to Goodwill. But try and experiment sometime, because it doesn't cost you anything. Just go home and unplug the dumb thing for a solid week. Now, I know you'll need therapy, because there will be a withdrawal period. And you'll be sitting next to your neighbor's door and looking in the window. You're going to have trouble. I know that. Just unplug it for a week and see if you can get along without it. Read the newspaper for your news. Or ask somebody, what do they say the news is this morning, or whatever. Do you think you could miss Wheel of Fortune, or you housewives that are home, The Price is Right, for 1 week? You might surprise yourself. O Eternal, you have searched me and known me. You know it when I sit down. You know it when I get up. You understand my thoughts afar off. You compass my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. Frightening thought. Frightening thought. Do you pick your nose when you're in your car by yourself? Now, I'm being humorous, of course. But believe it or not, you can drive down the freeway and you look at somebody driving alone and you only see about that much of his knuckle. And he's driving down the road, he's thinking, you know. I once saw a survey where they put that on national television and they showed how many people. It was unbelievably gross. Carl Malden. Can you imagine Carl Malden driving down the road? This, I tell you humorously, to get across a point. To get across a point. There is nothing you do that God is not watching. You have an audience all the time. Countless angels, if they are concerned and want to look, can look. God can look. 24 elders can look. Michael or Gabriel could look. The real Michael, not the other three I talked about. You're acquainted with all my ways, the way you do things. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Eternal, you know it all together. By the time you're framing words with your tongue, that you've conjured up thoughts with your mind, God's way ahead of you. He knows what you're going to say. For you have beset me behind and before, and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is just too wonderful, too amazing, too incredible for me. It is high. I cannot attain to it. And neither can you. None of us could. David can't. We can't. If David couldn't understand the fathomless knowledge in the mind of God. Now look what he's doing here. He's writing poetry, and he's writing music, and he is meditating. About what? He's not thinking about the way Goliath's arm looked in his greaves and brass and his shield. He's not thinking about his hero. He's not thinking about some new war machine. He's not adulating death and killing. He's not thinking about his tryst with Bathsheba. He's not thinking about anything except God. When was the last time you were practically moved to write a poem because you took time out and you got in communication with God and you let your mind just think of how great He is. When I get up there in Colorado and there's an old rotting stump and two or three little bitty blue spruce about that big and some other blue spruce about, and over there is a gorgeous bird and I can see for about 100 miles the snow-capped peaks of the Uintas way in the distance, and there's a running little brook there, and I'm breathing that sweet air and looking at the luscious grass and the little wildflowers, I can look up to heaven and just say with all of my heart and with eyes filling with tears, how great Thou art, O God, who made all of this and who made me and all these creatures. And if I had a pad, I might be tempted to write a little poetry. I don't. I don't know that I'd be good at poetry. But David was. And he had time to meditate and to think about the greatness of God. What did we just read back there? If you be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, and not all these mundane things down below. He said, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from your spirit, or whither shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend up to heaven, you're out there. You're there. I often thought as I was flying the Falcon jet back and forth across the Atlantic, I'd wonder if there was an angel sitting on the wing or maybe in the cockpit. Of course, he could go in and out of the cockpit if he wanted to, and maybe be out there looking at me like this on the wingtip. And I'm at 39,000 feet with the huge big fjords and mountains of Iceland down below me. I never failed to marvel on the rare day, I think maybe twice in my entire experience of maybe 45 or 50 crossings over there, the North Atlantic, to see the entire continent of Iceland without a cloud on it. 99% of the time it's totally covered and fog-bound and cloud and socked in and so on. But to see that gigantic big expanse of ice and to pick out Sob Story Radio, which is a radio beacon the United States operates on an ice pack out there, which is about 7 or 8 stories high, as big as this whole room and so on, with all kinds of guys in there, and it looked like a little tiny black speck. We'd call them on the radio and get a radar vector, a radar fix, I should say, on our position and check it with our Doppler and later on our INS to see if we were exactly where we were supposed to be. And unvaryingly, we would talk to the guys down there who were suffering from cabin fever. One of them was from Santa Paula, California, I remember one time. And they would be out there for about, 6 months and then go home for about 3 months and be out there for 6 months. And it was kind of a rugged duty. But when you're in an environment like that and you become conscious of God, I can remember the nights when the Aurora Borealis looked like it was right outside our windshield. We were flying at night from St. John's, Newfoundland and going across up in that direction to Iceland. And the Aurora Borealis was just dancing around like huge veils all around us. Looked like I could just pull a plane up and be there. Of course, it couldn't. It's probably a million miles out there. Incredible. Awesome sights. I told before the story, and there's no way I could relate this to you, but I thought I was experiencing the second coming of Christ. I really thought it. It was pitch black. We were coming across the country during the Feast of Tabernacles. I was in the Falcon jet, way up in the 30s of thousands of feet. The sun had just set. That means the world had just rolled away. And we're being held by gravity to our envelope of air and flying this great circle route. We're going out toward Los Angeles. Well, the sun was still shining on the other side of that horizon. It was pitch black where we were. The stars were out. And all of a sudden, we looked out our cockpit, and here was a brilliant white light rushing toward us with a core at the center of it that looked as bright as the sun, and it was just expanding out behind it like this and coming closer with the speed of a bullet. Not a one of us could croak a word. There was one in the jump seat, Frank Sherrick, Dan and I, and I was flying the Falcon jet. We were just transfixed. Good thing we had the plane on autopilot. No telling what we would have done. We kept looking and looking. About that time, some airline pilot came on the radio and he said, boy, I don't know what's going on, but something's happening out here. Other people began chiming in, yeah, what is it? Somebody says, I don't know. It took several minutes, and we finally were told by ATC that we had launched a missile from Vandenberg Air Force Base out into an orbit. And, of course, they go downrange, and it was going into space, but it was going straight away from us, and the sun was shining brilliantly on its vapor trail. And it looked the reverse of that. It looked like it was speeding toward us from outer space. And like we were held like a fly in a web transfixed, and this thing was going to absorb us. It was like I was seeing the second coming of Christ. The thought occurred to all three of us because I checked with the other two. What did you think it was? The thought occurred to us. I thought it might be the second coming of Christ. That's what we thought. That's because oftentimes when I was up there at night or day, I would have my mind on the things of God, even though I was flying a modern jet aircraft. If I ascend up to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, which is implied the grave, is the Hebrew word, not hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall your hand lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light around me. God sees in the darkness. Yea, the darkness hides not from thee, but the night shines as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. For you have formed, as it should read, me, my reins, and have covered me, or knit me together, as the margin says, in my mother's womb. Look up. Any one of these aspects of the human body, the birth process, your eye, your ear, your nose, your sensory systems, your nervous system, your skeletal system. Look up the human frame, the human body, the digestive system. Look up the stomach. Look up in an encyclopedia and learn, even from a college or a high school grade encyclopedia like World Book, some of the fabulous things of God. You can look up anything you want to that is living. Any tree, any bush, any animal, any insect. And you will discover there a wealth of knowledge that will stand you in awe of what His hand has done. I mean, if you can't get to the top of a mountain in Colorado and see that part of God's creation very often, if you've got to look at it in the flight of a bird outside your window, or the shrubs or the grass where you live, or a geranium in the pot, it's still there to behold. It is easy to look for God. It is easy to look for God. But it takes some thought and some planning. And you won't do it automatically or accidentally. You've got to retrain yourself to do so, because basically what we're looking for, what we're running toward, what we want, what we reach for our wallet for, what we're in a hurry for, what we get excited about, are our idols. Idolatry is alive and well in the United States. Now, unfortunately, many people think once they're in the church, once they're baptized and begotten of God's Spirit, no more idolatry. Let me give you the greatest shock of all. Many religious people have made an idol out of their religious leader. I am a sweaty 61-year-old human man up here with a stinking shirt the moment that I put on brand fresh and clean out of the shower, where I washed the crud off and went down the drain in my hotel. I'm not a demigod. I'm not superior to the most uneducated person in this room. I'm an absolute equal with you. I'm not special. I'm just one man. Once one of God's great prophets, we think of them as great on several occasions, and this is not only John in the book of Revelation, but Daniel and others, have had encounters with an angel. Daniel, when he was absolutely rigid and in a trance, was on his hands and knees. And that great archangel reached down and touched him on the shoulder and said, get up, worship God. I'm a servant of God like you. I'm just an angel. Well, if an angel could say that, why would a man want to worship a man? Many people have made a god out of their religious leader. When my sister was told by a member of the parent organization that if my father, Herbert W. Armstrong, told her to jump out the 7-story building, she would do it. My sister, not in the church, was aghast. She couldn't believe the degree of cultism, of absolute insanity, of a fixation, of making a man for whom she had no respect because of the way he treated her, making a man into God. I hate to tell you this, but others have gone a step further, or perhaps it's a step under that, and are worshiping a sort of a mass of people, an organization, an ism, a body called the church. And that to them is their ultimate authority. It's what hands down dictates to, directs, controls their lives. Christ does not. They don't have a personal relationship. They're not on their way home, I'm going to have a chance to talk to my Father in heaven in private. Whole different way of looking at it, isn't it? Can you imagine a Christian thinking, I've got to hurry, I've got to get home, I want to get on my knees and talk to God? That doesn't happen very often in most lives, does it? Think about it. Maybe the people out here in the world who are unchurched have their idols that we call stars and sports heroes and military and political heroes and so on. But there are a lot of church people who have made an idol out of their religious leader and made an idol out of their church. They're not worshiping God anymore. They're worshiping that church. Think about it. He says, yea, the darkness hides not from thee, but the night shines as the day. Verse 12. The darkness and the light also alike to thee. And we read this part, form me in my reins, form my reins, and has knit me together in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And there's what I was mentioning about the opportunity to get to an encyclopedia and find out the way you're made. Of course, anciently, people always wanted to make a statue of a man or of a woman. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in accordance or in continuance were fashioned when as yet there were none of them. I'm going to tell you some things that are a little bit perhaps tough to absorb in concluding this message today. First of all, does it feel good to sneeze? I don't know about you, but I really enjoy it. I get goosebumps all over my whole body. Get goosebumps. My goosebumps get little ducky bumps. I'm driving along, I get in my car, I'm on the way to work, it's humid down in East Texas, turn on the air conditioning, and pretty soon the cold air fighting the humid air, I'm going, almost drive off the road. I got to reconcentrate not to drive off the road, and just top my head and it blows off with this delicious sneeze. I look down, my arms are all covered with goosebumps. You know, you thought, you thought I was going to say something else. No. All of you sourpusses, hear that sound a few people just made? Somebody's sitting there like this and everybody's going, ha ha! Hear them rippling around through? What's that sound? That's a laugh. How do Vietnamese laugh? Same way we do. How do the Japanese laugh? Same way. I once turned away from a menu, a little Japanese girl looked at me, I was in the Navy, and had this handlebar mustache all the way around. She covered her face and just stood there and laughed. She was just tickled to death to see this weird-looking mustache I was wearing in the Navy. Does it feel good when you are fulfilling your childhood dreams that you talk to your pillow about if you were a girl or a boy and the man of your dreams comes along and you're going the traditional date and you're holding hands, you remember at the door that first kiss? Is that sweet? Does that feel good? Is that something you desired when you were that age? When you were 16, you go on a date, it's just wonderful. Who do you think built into you the capacity to laugh? Who do you think made a sneeze and makes it feel good instead of nearly knock you out and send you to the hospital because you got to clear your passages up there, hay fever or something? Who do you think gives you the capacity for love? Now I'm going to get a little tough and I'll just say it once. Man didn't invent orgasm. God Almighty built into the human family the greatest of all sensory, sensual feelings as his great and good gift to be used between two human beings who, unlike any other creatures on the face of this earth that creep, swim, walk, or fly, alone among the human family are capable in love, in the intimacy of marriage, which is a microcosm of the family and the kingdom of God, of looking into each other's eyes as they experience the greatest pleasure known to man. That embarrasses you? Just grow up spiritually. That's all I can say to you. Just grow up spiritually. Who gave us that gift? God Almighty in heaven, not the actors in Hollywood. Not dirty magazines, not centerfolds, not perverts, not Satan the devil or his demons, but God Almighty. He gave you the capacity to laugh and to love and to be loved. Now, why can't we get our minds on God and worship Him instead of going around in our mundane workaday routine with our minds 99, 4400% on this world, material things, entertainment, and oftentimes is not our idols? Let us, as God's people, as God's church, and all of you visiting with the church members here today, resolve today. Look around your house. You won't see any little statues, unless maybe you're a Catholic, you've got a St. Christopher, and you probably ought to think about that. You won't see any totem poles, the chances are, household gods, but you might look in the book in the magazine rack. You might look at your television habits. You might look at the stack of TV movies you're about to return when you go to get the next batch. You might look at who your favorites are, who you'd really like to hear interviewed, who you'd like next in your autograph pad. You might look and see whether or not there's any place in your life where you might be able to clean out some cobwebs and some old garbage and debris that has sort of crept in you weren't aware of, that is actually breaking the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." You cannot serve God and mammon. Almighty God is not satisfied with part-time Christians. He doesn't want you part of the time. He wants absolute, total, unconditional surrender. And now let me put the final question to you. I'm a male. I'm a married man. I'm a father and a grandfather, and I know what I'm talking about. That the greatest thing I can ever receive from my wife, from my grandchild, or my children, is when they look me in the eye and they say, "I love you." Do you ever say that to Jesus Christ of Nazareth? Do you ever let Him know that your love is to the degree of adoration? Because it's not wrong to worship Him. He wants that. But the point is, so do you. The most frustrated, unthought, unspoken, unrealized desires of your life, that great love that perhaps most human beings have never experienced and probably never will. But that motive, that desire back there, is what is called worship. And you are to worship your God. There's a green light. There's no law against going through it. Against such, against these things, there is no law. Worship God. Worship Jesus Christ. Get rid of your idols. Tell God you love Him. Go home and get that 139th Psalm out, and open it up on your knees and read through it slowly. And then do like I said, and get an encyclopedia, look up some of God's great creation, and begin to get your mind on Him. And don't forget to unplug that stupid television set for a week.